This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Reporter and writer Peggy Ornstein is our guest in this portion of the program. Her latest book is Flux, Women on Sex, Work, Love, Kids, and Life in a Half-Changed World. We'll talk with her about the dilemmas facing women at the outset of the 21st century. We've now seen a couple of generations of women who have grown up being told, you can do whatever you want to do. There are new opportunities for women. At the same time, traditional expectations regarding marriage and motherhood remain a strong pull. So women have tried to do it all, working high power, full tilt, being good wife and good mother. Is it doable? What is success? Peggy Ornstein interviewed more than 200 women between the ages of 25 and 45 over a four-year period for the book Flux. The book is recently out in a paperback edition from Anchor Books. Listeners, I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Peggy Ornstein is a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine and several other national publications. She is also the author of Schoolgirls, Young Women, Self-Esteem, and the Confidence Gap. Peggy, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to talk with you. It was a question raised when you were out talking with women about your first book, Schoolgirls, that led you to this project. Would you tell us what that question was and how it gave life to Flux?
Well, you know, after writing Schoolgirls, I was going around the country talking at universities and to parent groups, and inevitably, after I would speak for a while, somebody would raise her hand and say, why is it that when women have all these new opportunities that girls are still falling into these patterns of self-censorship and self-doubt? And I would give this kind of flip response that, you know, I'd say, well, you know, it's not like we adult women have it all figured out, is it? And everybody would laugh and they would move on. And after a while, I became troubled by how blithely we brush off the connection between what adult women are going through and what's going on in female adolescence, because, you know, the truth is that we're not really going to help them until we figure out what's going on for us. And I became very interested in what I felt were two messages, one that we gave to young girls and one that we were giving to adult women. And it was not just the content, but the tone of the message, so that we were saying to young women, you can be anything. You know, honey, you can be anything. And in this very encouraging way. And we were saying to adult women, honey, you can't have it all. And I felt that somewhere in between, in the gap between those two messages, there was something really important about how women were navigating the opportunities and the challenges of their lives right now.
Mm. Now when you meet with readers who've read Flux, what questions do they raise at readings and in discussion groups?
That's a great question. You know, mostly what they talk about is identification with the voices in the book and you know, what I really wanted out of this book was for it to kind of open up a conversation, because although we women have this kind of reputation for really talking to one another and processing things, I really found that ultimately women were very isolated in their own experience, and there's so much reluctance. You know, there's the kind of classic divisions like working moms and stay-at-home moms, but there were also divisions generationally, there were divisions by race, there were single childless women in the workplace and mothers in the workplace, and there was so much that we weren't saying to each other that felt so risky, because I think in a half-changed world, other people's choices can feel like a reproach. And so what I wanted to do was write a book that acted, that opened that conversation up in a safe way and allowed women to acted sort of as a mirror and a window, I guess, that allowed women to look into other women's lives and reflect on their own and maybe take a little risk and talk to one another a little more.
Mm. What does it mean, this idea of a half-changed world?
Well, Celeste, don't you know? Most women I talk to know pretty intuitively. You know, I think that things have obviously, so much has changed for women. We have so many new opportunities, but there's also so much much that hasn't changed in men's roles, in institutions, in our own psyche. And, you know, sometimes one of the examples I like to use is that the solutions that are offered can sometimes contain a seed of the problem. So one conversation I had was with a group of young medical students at the University of Pennsylvania, and they had just gone to a panel on work-family balance and were very eager mm-hmm. to talk to me about that. And so there were, you know, a number of female doctors who talked to them about how they had organized their professional and personal lives. And I said, well, that, you know, all sounds great. How many of your male classmates went to the panel? And they said, none. And I said, oh, okay, I get it. So they're going to have their own panel later on how to be good fathers and good dads. And they just, you know, looked at me like I just dropped down from Mars and said, you know, absolutely not. They wouldn't go to something like that. And I just thought, well, so what does that mean when these young women who've been struggling mightily and appropriately with issues of balance in life hook up with these guys who, you know, maybe have and maybe haven't, but haven't been required to? And so in thinking about that, I've become very suspicious about that word balance, although I haven't found a better word exactly. But I feel that as long as it's just applied to women, balance is just a code word for compromise and contradiction. Mm. So while I'm all for it, you know, I'm all for prioritizing our lives, we have to shift the paradigm so that this balance business is not just women's domain.
Yeah. The young woman in the book, Mira Brody, and mm-hmm. others told you, these are the young women, they told you they wanted to see changes made in the highest echelons of business, and that's what they were out to do. But to do that, they'd have to be there, they'd have to get there to the top. And right now, they're in a place where being recruited, one dares not ask about family leave policies. Perhaps if you're a woman and married, you take off your wedding band.
Well, I was very surprised by that. Mira and one of her friends were talking to me about that, and they were business school students at Columbia, which has the largest percentage of women of any major business school, and business school's female enrollment has been dropping steadily, as a matter of fact. That's somewhere where we're going backwards. And they talked about, you know, they would say things like, well, you know, to have a baby before the vice president level is death, but they didn't want to ask about it, so they felt caught in this double bind. And it was a real difficult thing for women. Young women talked a lot about the conflict between wanting to do meaningful work, which was in, you know, the kind of traditional realms for women in social work or teaching or taking a law degree and working in the public domain in some way, or doing work that would put them in male-defined fields with male rules, but would pay a lot more and get them to the top and felt more prestigious. And that was kind of a conflict all the way along that started, you know, while women mm-hmm. were still in college, really.
Mm-hmm. These women seem to go back and forth between wanting to be a first-grade teacher and a CEO.
Yeah, and some of that was about men. But, you know, I should probably back up right. a minute and just explain the way that the book works a little bit. I interviewed, as you said in the beginning, about a couple hundred women overall, and those women were between about 25 and 45, which is what life course psychologists call young adulthood when you're setting up your career and making decisions about marriage and childbearing and that sort of thing. And I broke those, ended up breaking the book into three parts. The Promise Years, which looked at women right out of college. The Crunch, which looks at women sort of around their 30s when the promise and contradiction all kind of gets balled up at once. And then the Reconsideration, which looked at women at midlife who are asking a new question and a very profound question of what do I want for myself now. And within those sections, there's an introductory chapter that has voices from a lot of women. And then I wanted to go in deep with individual women like Mira, who you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. So that women and men, too, could really read about how individual women navigated these issues in our lives and use that as a jumping-off point for reflection.
Did you ever have occasion to get a discussion going among women at these different stages of their lives? In other words, do the stories of a 25-year-old resonate with someone who's 35 or 45? I think the answer there is yes. But what about from the back end, those of a 45-year-old, do they resonate with someone who's 25?
Well, that's a really, you know, I hoped that they would. And some of the chapters, I mean, it was interesting. When I did the groups, the group interviews. I would get, you know, 4 to 6 women together in groups initially and do interviews, and then eventually pulled the individuals that I spent a long period of time with from those groups. I couldn't really have the younger women and the older women in groups effectively. The psychology of the groups was fascinating, trying to figure out what would allow women to really let it down and speak their minds and tell the truth. If I had groups of friends together, that was a bad idea, because friends tend to, when one woman would start to say, you know, I'm really not sure about that decision, I really look back with, you know, and wrestle with something, that the friend would jump in and say, oh, no, that was the only thing you could, you know, we would immediately try to assuage and make people feel better, which is exactly what you don't want when you're reporting. You want people mm-hmm. to feel free to speak. So that didn't work. Younger women and older women were a little bit embattled. There was a sense among women in their mid-40s that young women were kind of ungrateful, and a sense among women, the younger women, that the older women had made kind of compromised choices that they didn't respect necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I really, you know, if I were doing more of a, you know, if I wasn't reporting, if I were doing these groups for another purpose, I would really make an effort to get those women together. And I always think when I'm, you know, speaking somewhere like Champaign-Urbana, where there's a big university community, there's so much potential, because university life is one of the few times when there's a big group of younger women and a big group of somewhat older women who interact a lot and can really talk to one another. It just doesn't happen that much.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very interesting that, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, and I can certainly see where these young women are coming from. They're getting their lives on track, and I can certainly understand where they are. I was there once, a long time ago. But at the same time, it seems that there's a hunger on the part of these younger women for mentors.
Yes.
So that there is a great opportunity for talking with one another.
Yeah, I think that there is. There's a big window there that that really can happen, and I was hoping, you know, in the book, there are several chapters that I think really do talk to each other, and particularly the last chapter of the book, which is about a woman named Denise Littleton, who is, she's sort of, what I always say is she's the woman that initially you kind of love to hate, because she seems to have everything all together. You know, she's got this gorgeous husband who's really a great guy and helps with the kids, and two kids and a job that's, you know, really fulfilling to her, but she only has to work 4 days a week and she makes a lot of money, and she just kind of makes you gnash your teeth. But then you sort of see all she had to go through to get there, and she's both a lesson in what needs to change and also in the potential. And I felt her story spoke very directly back to a number of the younger women, I think to Mira, who you mentioned, and also there's the medical student who is a young African American woman, to her, and those back and forth. I think both those in both directions. And when the book came out, Denise actually wrote me a letter and told me to say hi to a couple of the younger women who she mm-hmm. really felt the connection with through the book.
Yeah. Let's start with a listener on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Pretty good. I just had a couple of comments and then one question. I'm a stay-at-home dad, and I used to have the fairly high-powered career in Chicago, and when my wife moved down here as a faculty member, we decided that since we wanted to have a family, that commuting wasn't going to work. So since she was tenure-track, we sort of switched the traditional roles, at least by the sort of American standard. I became the full-time caregiver, and she became the career person. And it is amazing to me how many people, mostly women, tell me what a strong man I am for having done this, and isn't it amazing that you have the sort of personal self-confidence that you don't worry about the socialization, and yet women have been doing this for millennia and really get no credit at all for taking care of the family. And it's funny because I have to escape some of my own socialization demons, because I think, you know, I should be earning a paycheck. There are a lot of days I think we made a huge mistake. She'd be a better parent than I would. She's more nurturing. Maybe I yell at my kids too much or whatever. But it's just, in Champaign-Urbana, we could do that on one income. And my question is more about American society. I mean, I think the lion's share of the blame lies squarely at the feet of the male population. I mean, no one's willing to shoulder even half the load. I mean, I'm sure you've read The Second Shift by Arlie Hochschild and her later books, where basically women pick up the slack almost everywhere. But do you think, to a certain extent, American society, which is so focused on work and so against sort of more than 2 weeks vacation, the way that, say, Europeans are set up, and even in Canada, a woman can take a year off from her job after maternity, and her job is guaranteed. I think it's 6 months paid leave and a year where her position is kept safe for her. And I think American sort of business society just doesn't focus on any of those things. They're so concerned with maximizing profit and climbing the ladder, like you say, to become vice president. I used to work for a consulting firm where if a woman had a baby, they just never expected her to come back.
Right.
And people who actually came back and wanted to work, which the lion's share of women want to do, I think, who are professional to begin with,
right,
you know, people were just shocked, and their career track in terms of promotion was totally derailed because people just assumed that at some point, if she had had a kid or was going to have another kid, that she couldn't be a really equally beneficial member to the firm, in this case management consulting, as a male member who'd stayed the whole way, which is just ridiculous. Not
right,
even getting into all the different perspectives that a woman
mm-hmm.
can bring, or
I
even a nurturing
so often.
Individual.
I heard that very often, that women would be, you know, guilty of motherhood until proven innocent at work. And I love that I can hear your child in the background.
Yeah, well, you got a limited amount of time before they melt down, and I sorry.
But yeah, you know, the one thing I really wanted out of Flux was for it to be accessible to men, and there's a lot of male perspective in it, and there's two chapters in particular that I think would be interesting for you. Two different couples, one that expected to have a very egalitarian division of labor and then ended up with a very traditional one with the woman at home and the guy at work, and the other couple that... that was the reverse. They expected something very traditional and ended up with something much more egalitarian, where he was much more of a nurturing parent. But the one of the guys in those chapters took paternity leave, and that's something that still, I mean, you know, Tony Blair, that the whole thing with Tony Blair in England was so amazing that he even considered taking a paternity leave, with something that just, you know, doesn't happen in America. And there was a study of by talking to CEOs and human resource managers about how much time men should take off after the birth of a baby. What do you think that most of them said?
Friends who have first babies, male friends, that is, and they are working on their whatever 2 weeks or 10 days of paternity leave they get, or the Family Medical Leave Act. They take their work home, and they say, well, you know, I'm going to be home, but I'm going to be working, and the office can always reach them, and it's just ridiculous. I mean, I love kids. I've always loved kids, so... For me, it wasn't that big of a sacrifice, and maybe I just wasn't much of a networker anyways, but I just didn't get it. But one thing as a stay-at-home dad I found, and, you know, obviously women have it much tougher, I think, than I do, but it's incredibly isolating in one sense, because since you didn't actually go through pregnancy and delivery, a lot of women, I don't think they really can relate, or they don't really want to include you in some things because you didn't do the whole thing. So it can be isolating. I've been to a few groups here in town where, say, for example, my kid is in a little music program where I go 5 out of 6 weeks and I get, you know, extreme cordiality from all the women, but my wife goes once,
right,
and they say, oh, you're Joaquin's mother. Why don't you come, you know, every class after class you go to such and such's house and we have coffee and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, whoa. I mean,
well, that was a big issue for men who were home on paternity leave or who stayed home. The answer to the earlier question I asked, by the way, is that 2/3 of human resource managers and CEOs said that it was appropriate for men to take no time off when they had, at the birth of a child, none whatsoever. But, you know, as much as women have gone into the workforce and the world of men, men have not been integrated into the home and the world of women in the same way, so that when men are home, there's some suspicion when they're with their kids. A lot of men would say to me that daycare providers or teachers would say to them when they pick their child up, remember to tell your wife that your child needs a popsicle stick, you know, popsicle sticks for the project, or, you know, play groups, you know, gymboree, all that stuff is dominated by women, and it's a pretty rare man who feels comfortable hanging out in the coffee crotch with the women, so there's not a lot of support. And when you have small children at home, as women know, it's incredibly important to have an outlet with adult friends that you can you can talk to. So
I mean, that
does make it hard. And then there's the suspicion of mothers themselves when there's a guy on the playground. You know, they think maybe he's a child molester.
Right.
Or
exactly.
Some women have said to me, you know, off the record, I got to tell you, I think guys who stay home with kids are losers. And so there's that, you know, and those are things that, you know, when we talk about change and moving things forward, there's a whole big set of things that you brought up earlier about the our nation's skewed perspective on work and how how work over-dominates our life. But there's also these things that we can change in our own kind of heads and hearts that have to do with how we think about men and how we think about women and motherhood, because that's another big issue, too.
Yeah, and it's so ingrained. I mean, Celeste probably may recognize my voice. I call into all of these shows every day, practically, because I'm so starved for adult conversation. It's ridiculous. But the other thing I was going to say is you have to escape your own socialization. I mean, and it's really hard. People on an intellectual level can say, you know, this is ridiculous. If, you know, she has to work, I have to stay home, or vice versa. But it's amazing how hard that is. When I meet male friends or even in my family members, I have a big extended family, even with my father, when people find out for the first time that I'm at home, I feel like I have to launch into this long explanation of how we got here starting, you know, 10 years ago and the whole tenure system and this is the way it works and blah, 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 blah. And it's just, you know, I know that I shouldn't have to do that. It's perfectly reasonable for me to raise the kids. But at the same time, somehow it feels wrong sometimes. It's just very strange.
You know, whenever I have conversations like this with people, which I went, Celeste, when you were asking earlier about the responses to the book, this is the kind of conversation that's pretty typical, you know, either with men or with women. I always think, boy, I wish I knew you guys when I was doing the interview.
Yeah, anyways, I'll hang up before these guys crash.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for calling.
I think in university towns it's somewhat more common. It seems to be somewhat more common for men to be at home because I've found that when men are at home, they tend to be in... And that maybe it's the liberalism of the town, or maybe it's just the way that the economics work.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what the situation would be for men who are on a tenure track, if it would be the same situation.
Yeah, perhaps not.
Yeah. There still remains, it seems, a gap between what's expected of mom and what's expected of dad, as this caller raised in so many aspects of his life.
Right.
How are couples negotiating that good mom, good dad stuff?
Well, I had one group of women that I was talking to, and they sort of did the whole litany of complaints about their husbands that I'm sure a lot of your listeners know too well. And then one of them paused and said, "But you know, he's a lot better dad than his own dad was." And I said, "Yeah, but maybe that's not the right yardstick. Maybe you should be measuring him against you." And she turned to me and said, "Well, that's not going to happen." And I said, well, isn't that ironic that where we are now is that no matter what women do as mothers, they feel this kind of guilt and anxiety, and yet we let men feel like better dads with even sort of a little more participation. But, yeah, you know, a lot of, I think, what keeps the, it's, you know, men need to participate more, and there's no question about that, and that needs to be something they need to do. But we women also have to let them. And that was a big issue, too, that women, you know, that there were these two little creatures on women's shoulders that when they became mothers, one was the bad mother, you know, the bad mother, which is like kryptonite to women, to call them that. And I really think it's one of the biggest, along with, you know, calling young girls, when I was doing schoolgirls, fat and slut, you know, bad mother was mm-hmm. way up there for adult women in flux as the thing that would just make you recoil from any attempt to have individual interests or anything, you know. And then on the other shoulder was the perfect mother, who is the woman who has no, whose needs are completely inextricable from her children's. And those two little voices would be in women's heads and result in this kind of, you know, this guilt. And what women, particularly women in the workforce, would do to kind of assuage that would be to micromanage kids' lives. And, you know, that somehow if you clung to the small stuff, that was what made you feel like a good mother, even when it went against your own well-being. And when I was going around after the hardcover of Flux, one woman came up to me at a reading, and she said, "After reading this book, I've decided that I'm not going to edit my daughter's lunches anymore." And I said, what does that mean? And she said, "Well, it's my husband's job to go down and to make lunch for our daughter every day. But when he's done, I sneak into the kitchen and I look in the bag to make sure that he's, you know, represented the four basic food groups and all of that." And she said, "I'm just going to let that go." And she was going to give herself that, you know, psychic space. She was going to give him that authority. And she was going to, you know, just release that. And I think a lot of that comes down to you know, would she, I said, why did you have to do it? And she said, well, you know, if she goes to school and she's got three bags of potato chips and a piece of cake for lunch, nobody's going to think, what a bad dad. They're going to say, you know, oh, that girl's got a terrible mother. And it's that kind of judgment. You know, that's the real price of the perfect mother, is this constant judgment against ourselves and against other mothers that we engage in. Mm-hmm. And it's so crippling to women. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just lately I've been starting this like one person campaign where I was working out at my, I live in Berkeley, and I was working out at the Y here, and I always see this woman with her children, and she's really great. You know, I really enjoy watching her, and I went up to her and said, you know, you're so joyful with your kids. I really like watching you, and you're just a really great mom. And tears came to her eyes, and she said, you know, I don't feel like such a great mom all the time. And I said, well, you need to know you are, and I stalked off. And, you know, I thought, she probably thought I was some kind of a nut, but I just thought, you know, we just have to give one another a break and give each other that support that there, you know, are so many ways to parent, and they all work, and we have to let go, because it's just, you know, we're not going to be able to bring men in the way that we want to, or encourage them or force them or anything until we can let go of the psychological grip of the good mother.
Mm. Another follow-up to our first caller this afternoon. Men, this was interesting to read in your book, men in a dual career marriage, in dual career marriages, don't rise through the ranks as quickly, and they earn less than male single earner peers. So
yeah.
the male single earner, they could be married, but they're in a...
Well, in other words, yeah, the guys who are in traditional relationship where they're making all the money, yeah.
So what kind of a daddy penalty is out there?
Well, there's a daddy penalty out there, but there's also a great daddy reward. I mean, I suppose it's the same, you know, it's the same price that women pay, and there could be two reasons. I mean, one could be for the same reasons that I mean, and it's similar to, I think it's a similar web to women's, to what happens to women, that on one hand, they're probably making choices that compromise the career track a little bit because they want to spend time with family. They're probably somewhat discriminated against because they want to spend time with family, and perhaps because they're not the sole breadwinner, they don't have to earn quite so much money. It's, you know, the whole family economic stability isn't dependent upon them. And I think, you know, they don't say that in the study, so I don't know. But that was something that men talk in egalitarian relationships or dual career families talked a lot about, the feeling, the psychic feeling of relief in not being the one who is solely responsible. And one of the chapters that I mentioned earlier, in which that talks about a couple that he really wanted her to stay home with the kids, and right before she had their first child, he was laid off. And, you know, nobody ever expects that to, I mean, maybe now people are starting to tip to it, but, you know, people don't expect it to happen. And suddenly, you know, if they had just had the one income, they would be in big trouble. So he was home, actually, for a while, but she retained her job, and then he got, you know, he found another job after a few months. But he said he hadn't expected what a relief it would be after having that experience. It so shook his faith in job security that he just felt much better knowing that she was working, too, and that was a real boon to their marriage, actually.
Yeah. It's interesting to see how life changes us as we move along and we get more and more experiences of unemployment, illness, divorce. Even death.
Well, and it was something that, it's funny, you know, the young women, that was a little alarming how little young women expected that or prepared for that, how willing they were to dismiss it in the ways that they were approaching both their relationships and their career paths. I mean, they just did not consider that, you know, divorce, death, layoffs, disability, all the things that anybody who is, you know, when I would start interviewing women in their 30s and 40s, inevitably, in any group of six women that I brought together, one of those things had happened to them, to their husbands, or obviously not death to them, but, you know, these other things could have happened to them as well. And so many things happen in life that we really have to be ready. And women tended to think, young women tended to think about career and economic stability as personal. They would think they wanted to be able to support themselves, but they really still didn't have the mindset of believing that they would have to support or certainly help support in a significant way a family. And yet many, many women obviously do now.
And these women who are in that stage of life, I would imagine, and I think that you do report this in the book, their families experienced these things. So growing up, they saw, you know.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah.
I mentioned that at one point, particularly with divorce, that the young women, the post-college women, they certainly came from families with divorce at the same rate as everybody else, but they believed that because of what they had learned in watching their parents, that it wouldn't happen to them, that they were going to make better choices. And, you know, another thing was they didn't have much perspective on what it would mean. You know, I'd say to them, what if, you know, how about women who are single and childless at 40? And they'd say, well, you know, that's fine. Lots, you know, you can do anything you want to these days. And I'd say, but what if you were single and childless at 40?
And God forbid, they said.
Yeah, one actually said, God forbid, and knocked on wood. And that was so, it was so not in keeping with what women who were single and or childless by midlife, how they talked about their lives. And they had found such rich ways to create community, to create a sense of family, to connect to the next generation. And I felt it was very important to have that voice. And when I wrote the book, I felt that was important because I felt that without a good sense of that, that young women were just as vulnerable as their mothers or their grandmothers to making choices out of fear rather than desire. They just had, like, you know, an extra 10 years before the panic set in. But now, I don't know if you're aware of the campaign to remind women that their fertility wanes in their 30s, but I felt that it was particularly valuable in the wake of that campaign.
Mm. I don't know. I think that there are three things that I would say to young women that would be, number one, being alone is not the worst thing that can happen to you. Number two, whether or not you have children, that's an important decision, but children don't have to define your life.
That's right. And what...
Number three is do not lose control of your sexual being and your sexuality and those decisions about who you are as a woman.
Yeah, and we haven't talked about that because that's, you know, I actually so often when I do a show or interviews or particularly readings, we don't talk about it because I think it's still a very difficult issue.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, when I'm talking to a group, they don't really want to talk about it that much.
Yeah.
The ways that women lose their sexual selves and disconnect from it. And that was one of the most direct links between my work in schoolgirls and my work in Flux, because what I saw in schoolgirls was the beginning of that, was that girls were not learning to understand their own desire. They were learning about danger. They were learning to, you know, stop boys' desire, but they weren't connecting with their own sense of desire and pleasure. And I've noticed in myself that when I speak, I recently was at the University of Richmond, and I was doing two talks, one to parents of teenagers on girls' issues and one to college students on adult women's issues, and I noticed that I talked about sexual desire really, I didn't talk about sexual desire with the parents of girls. It's so hard to do that. And yet with the college women, they wanted to talk about it extensively. And I talked about it much more openly with them. And I thought, boy, you know, it's still true that we expect girls to sort of, we deny their desire, we deny their bodies for years and years and years, and then they're supposed to spring fully formed, completely understanding them and able to have an entitled sense of their own sexuality. And it's just not realistic.
Yeah. Well, in the book, one thing that came through loud and clear to me in The Promise is that many of the young women became sexually active at a very young age, and almost to a woman, it wasn't a good experience.
Right.
And you lose power in that situation.
Yeah, and what girls were learning when they became sexually active was that sex was about boys, and it was about fulfilling male pleasure, and it was about suppressing their own, and it was rare. There was one woman, who was talking about her, who said she had her first orgasm when she was 16 with a boyfriend, and all of her friends, just their mouths dropped open, and she said, well, he was Swedish. And that was her kind of explanation. But it was hard for women to come to a place where they were feeling assertive about their sexuality. And when I talked to a group of women in their 20s in New York, you know, they knew what they were. They would say, well, what you're supposed to be able to do is ask for what you want. And somebody said, but, you know, I really can't do that still, and it's very hard to do, and it would even extend, you know, beyond the realm of pleasure into the realm of protection of not insisting that men wear condoms. And a lot of their, actually, I interviewed a young woman from University of Illinois who said that she found that in college a lot of her sexual experience involved hooking up, which was just kind of getting drunk and falling into bed with guys, but not not a real erotic or connected experience, and it just wasn't something that sex was just not, it wasn't for erotic pleasure, it was kind of for comfort or snuggling or for the guy.
Mm, pretty deadening. Let's talk with another listener who's waiting for us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
I hesitate to break into this interesting trend that you're on because we don't get around to talking about these things very often, but what I was calling about was the phenomenon of Andrea Yates and women's reactions to it. I haven't exactly talked with a lot of people about it, but I've been surprised by a couple of reactions. And there was a column in our local newspaper, a sophisticated columnist, where this woman really bashed some feminists who kind of stuck up for Andrea Yates. And I'm intrigued by that. So many people are, from my own tiny survey here, very not understanding and very judgmental.
I'm sorry, or what?
Very judgmental.
Uh-huh.
Want to see the death penalty.
Really?
It seems to me that maybe we're threatened by the idea that a woman could go bonkers taking care of her children. And she's being portrayed by some people as a, you know, a devil kind of person. And yet, when I read the Newsweek account of the whole thing, here she had been taking care of her father with Alzheimer's, homeschooling her children, and was totally subsumed by, maybe that's not the right word, totally taken over by her need to do for others. There wasn't much left of her from the description in Newsweek. And this couple was not apparently not using birth control, was just having child after child. They were having whatever child God gave to them.
Right.
She was a Catholic, had a Catholic background, as I understand, although I'm not sure that the couple were practicing Catholics at this point. But I just don't understand why people are reacting that way. It seems to me that we're frightened by the whole idea that a woman, that this could happen to somebody, that a woman would not naturally be, could not always naturally be a perfect mother.
Right. Well, Andrea Yates, yes, was the woman in Texas who killed her five children. And it's interesting that you say that people are so judgmental, because what surprised me in the press accounts of those murders was how many women kind of came out of the closet and said, well, no, I wouldn't kill my kids, but there sure were days. You know, there sure were days. And Anna Quindlen in that Newsweek, that same Newsweek, wrote a wonderful column about it, about the pressure, you know, the pressure to be perfect, the perfect mother, and to give and give and give, just as you said, is so intense that you disappear. And there are days when you just feel you're going to crack under the strain. And, of course, that doesn't... But that doesn't excuse murdering your children. But people identified, a lot of women identified just with the idea of breaking the taboo that mothers are perfect and love their children every single second and don't have any separate needs. That part of it, I felt, struck a real chord in a lot of women and opened some conversation that I had never seen in national forums before.
We seem to have this problem with make a distinction between excusing and understanding so as to prevent. And
exactly.
Then what do you do for this person?
Exactly.
Do you exact the death penalty, which is what the state of Texas is going for? Is that going to keep other women who are psychotic from postnatal depression from doing the same thing? I don't think so.
Exactly.
And in, if it's not going to prevent... other people, and if it's certainly not going to cure, it's not going to help her or her family. It just seems to be an overreaction to our fear that women when women don't behave as we expect them to behave as mothers.
I'm completely with you on that. Couldn't have said it better.
Well, keep on with the discussion about the sexuality. Now, but we've gotten off on a different sidetrack because I do think we need to talk more about that. I'm reading Starhawk's Dreaming the Dark right now, and she has some important things to say about sexuality and so forth.
Great. Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Reporter and writer Peggy Ornstein is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with her about her book, Flux, Women on Sex, Work, Love, Kids, and Life in a Half-Changed World. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. I don't know where to go exactly after that last call. I suppose we can return to the issue of young women and how they reclaim the power of their sexuality. Does that happen as women age in their 30s and 40s if they have been women who have had a bad experience or a less than whole or fulfilling experience in their younger years in terms of sex?
Well, it can, and let's get back to that in a second, but I just wanted to say one more comment about what the caller brought up, which is that I find that there are constantly stories in the media that just so well illuminate the issues of half change. The Andrea Yates story was one, and what I alluded to earlier, the Newsweek, it was also Newsweek, the cover of Newsweek, the fertility crisis that was last month about a campaign across country to tell young women that they better have babies younger and younger, which yet did not address the structural, institutional forces that make that extremely difficult. And I just, you know, about every 3 or 4 months, there's another story that I just think, wow, that's just like the perfect illustration of the both the progress and the punishment of women in our contemporary world. But to get back to your question on sexuality, it was kind of all over the map. You know, it continued to be very difficult to talk to women about sexuality. Once they had children, you know, it was pretty classic that sex lives fell apart and that women who were doing, again, giving so much, who were, you know, giving so much emotional, psychological energy to their children, to their work if they were working, you know, just didn't have... What one woman said to me was when she could get away with her husband somewhere, when they could go away for a weekend, she would feel like herself again, and then she would feel sexual. And I thought that was so interesting because you need to feel like yourself. You need to feel a sense of self to feel a sense of sexual agency. And they just felt that you know, when so much of their sense of self was sapped. At the same time, the good news was that two things. One, that as children grow up and leave home, sex lives often rebounded, and that women become more, you know, every study shows that women become more sexually confident as they age, so that's sort of some good news, too. But, you know, it was harder, the two things that were hardest to talk to women about were sex and, you know, their sex lives and money, and I'm not sure. I think actually sex was easier than money.
We haven't even talked about money. And you quote a family therapist in the book, Betty Carter, as saying, it's the golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules. This will have to be our last question here this afternoon. What's the biggest issue money raises in a woman's view of herself and in her relationships with her husband and her kids?
That's too big of a big question.
That's time.
What I saw with young women was that they were unconsciously gravitating towards men who would be higher earners, so that they would have, you know, what felt like an insurance policy to them, that if they decided, you know, if it was going to be possible, which it often isn't in our society, but if they decided that they wanted to stay home or cut back, they would be able to. But they would, what they were really buying, the fine print of that policy was that they were going to have to, because what I found was that men tend to use money to buy dominance, to do what they want to do. In other words, they won't, if they make significantly more money, they're not going to do housework and childcare. Women use money to buy equality. So when women made more money, The men didn't, you know, do everything. They just did their share. And one example was a journalist I interviewed who was her family's primary breadwinner. Her husband was a part-time academic. And, you know, I said, well, what do you do at home? And she said, well, of course, I'm always trying to find more time with my children, and then I do the cooking and this and that. She gave me this whole long list. She made 80% of the family income. I said, so imagine a family where men make, you know, 80% of the family income and the woman is making 20%. How much time do you think he would be spending thinking about how he could make sure that he was doing his share of the housework? You know, maybe he would, but what we mostly see is that they wouldn't. And so it really puts another spin on women's economic power and, you know, tipping the scales a bit in an opposite direction to make them be more equal.
Mm. Peggy, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me, Celeste.
Peggy Orenstein has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Her book, Flux, Women on Sex, Work, Love, Kids, and Life in a Half-Changed World, is just out in a paperback edition from Anchor Books.